The last case I want to get into is this 55-year-old lady that you have, Estella Murray.
Yeah, so she was 55, a non-smoker computer programmer. She was having headaches and was getting a neurological workup, and they thought that she may have had multiple sclerosis, which actually wasn't the case. Brain imaging was normal, but in that workup, they did lung imaging and found incidental 2-centimeter right lower lobe mass. So she was referred to our institution for surgery. She had had a PET scan that had no mediastinal involvement or extrathoracic disease, and this neurological process resolved and was not an issue. So when she went for surgery, the surgeon actually called me and he told me, I just did a wedge resection on this 55-year-old woman, non-smoker, and she has pleural metastases. And what do I do? Do I complete the surgery? Do I stop? Do I do a lobectomy? So I told him, you know, she's young. You have enough tissue for what we need to do next, which is mutation analysis. Let's just stop at the wedge resection and we'll go from there. So I met her in the hospital, very smart woman, and I talked to her about this unexpected finding that technically now she had M1A disease, she had metastatic disease, and she knew what that meant. And I told her, you know, I think it's really important that we get a molecular analysis, so we're going to see you again in the office, and we're going to send this expedited. So expedited was like 3 to 4 weeks that she was tormenting about this foundation report that she got. So she was wild type for EGFR, ALK, and ROS. Had a red rearrangement. But when we re-imaged her, she really had no measurable disease. So we were looking at clinical trials for her, but she had no measurable disease. Yeah. So we gave her standard chemotherapy with carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab. And I told her, usually this regimen goes for a certain amount of cycles, and then we do maintenance. So she wasn't interested in the maintenance because she had no measurable disease. And so I have gotten to know this woman for 17 months where I have observed her have no measurable disease. And it's been a very interesting kind of, what do you do? What does someone young...
Off treatment now for that long.
For that month, yeah. And then what do you do with your life when you're 55 and you're told that you have an incurable cancer that is not showing up in pictures? So what she has done is what I would have done. She has traveled. So she has been really amazing. She has joined this community of young lung cancer survivors on the internet. So she's paired with a buddy, someone who talks to her about her scans. And she has made a point just to travel every 2 months. So she does freelance computer programming so she can do that. And she has no children. So she has become kind of like a friend because I feel like myself, like she's trying to enjoy life as much as she can. So she has like a vision board. I think I'm on her board. And she has all these trips that she wants to do. But it's very, every time we go through a scan, it's very anxiety provoking for her, for me. I just think about her a lot because she's near my age. So I just think about, you know, how your life changes and when things are not going as bad as expected, but you think they're going to go bad.
Her scans have remained NED?
NED.
So this is an interesting dilemma. It's not that uncommon. That frantic phone call from the surgeon in the OR, there's pleural mets, I have to abort the surgery, what should I do? How do you expect us to tell you what to do? But technically that patient, particularly if it's multiple pleural mets, is not curable, but obviously they can have extended survival. And I think the biggest issue, one of the big issues you're dealing with here is scanxiety, which is a very real phenomena. And the only solution for that is getting scans less often, which in turn will trigger more anxiety because you're not monitoring it often enough. So it's often a no-win situation. I know in Canada, Frances Shepherd has talked about this when she has folks who are doing really well on, say, EGFR inhibitors in the face of EGFR mutation. She tries to scan them as little as possible.
So I'm curious, would you have given her some type of maintenance if she would agree to it?
She's so young, I would have, because I expected her to progress. Yeah.
How would you approach therapy? Would you use maintenance in this lady?
Traditionally, I would have done maintenance chemotherapy. But then for some reason, one reason or the other, a good number of our patients who have been on maintenance therapy on pemetrexed come off after a year or two. Two common reasons, cumulative fatigue and swelling of the lower extremities. You know, it causes some vascular toxicity, so they have this brawny edema and that they find it a little bit difficult to handle. I do have a 34-year-old who came in very sick, like what we had discussed earlier on, did fairly well after initial therapy. I've been watching enough of almost 3+ years with slow growth of multiple bilateral nodules off therapy, And so now, a similar situation, you do more scans, more anxiety, less scans, more anxiety. Now and then I have alternated chest x-rays with the cat's CT scan, especially if they have a chest dominant disease. These are asymptomatic patients enjoying their lives, and they really don't have great enthusiasm to pursue other things.
Do try to negotiate these folks into less frequent scans, that they can stand the anxiety of not doing it, particularly in the absence of new symptoms, and with the knowledge that their scans have been relatively stable through that period. And with the caveat, obviously, that you'll get a scan in between the scheduled follow-up if new symptoms appear. I have a very similar patient who's now on their sixth year of pemetrexed maintenance with intermittent toxicities. So at one point did develop fluid retention. For whatever reason, we were able to get it better. Has had some creatinine issues, which is another concern with pemetrexed. Invariably, after 2, 3, 4 years, I've seen creatinines rise. We lower the dose. We don't really know what we're doing, but we lower the dose, or we expand the interval, or do both. The other cumulative side effect I've encountered, which has triggered termination of treatment, is epiphora, hyperlacrimation. You can see that with other drugs as well. I've certainly seen it with taxanes. I've seen it peculiarly with pemetrexed. You think, well, that's not so bad, except if your eyes are tearing all the time, it's not so good either. So these low-grade cumulative toxicities become major quality of life issues.
We hear about the long-term responses with checkpoint inhibitors, but before that, I would hear occasionally people who were on pemetrexed maintenance for a long time, mm-hmm. and I always wondered whether it's just an indolent disease or some subtype that's particularly sensitive to pemetrexed. Any thoughts?
I think it's more than indolent disease. You know, you go back to another era, certainly those of us who are old enough to remember the 80s or 90s, you never saw patients mm-hmm. like this. We didn't see 5, 6, 7, 10, 12-year survivors. Now, granted, some of these folks probably did have oncogenic drivers even then, but they didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So she has asked me about liquid biopsies as another way of measuring her disease. She did have this red rearrangement, and we did look into trials, but you have to have measurable disease, so she can't go in a trial. So she has asked me, should we try to get this compassionate use, but she's not symptomatic, or should we follow her disease in another way? So I thought about this idea of doing blood testing, but I don't know how it would impact.
I would get at least a baseline and see what exists. With such a low tumor burden, you probably find nothing, or maybe just